I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. I've seen the preview to Baz Luhrmann's 3D $127 million film adaptation of The Great Gatsby several times, and I have to say that's not my image of F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel. The movie opens tomorrow, and we'll see what the critics and moviegoers have to say. The Great Gatsby was published in 1925, received lackluster reviews, and sold just 20,000 copies in the first year. Today, it's considered one of the great American novels. So today on Radio Times, what makes The Great Gatsby so great? And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Michael Trattner is a professor of English and Film Studies at Bryn Mawr College. And Michael, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us, Suzanne Del Gizzo. She's an associate professor of English at Chestnut Hill College. And Suzanne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
So Suzanne, what makes The Great Gatsby so great?
Well, I think initially, on the most basic level, it speaks to things that Americans are obsessed with. Youth, wealth, privilege, money, self-making, identity. But I think ultimately what makes it a really great novel is Fitzgerald's attitudes towards those things. He's completely ambivalent. He celebrates them and he critiques them all at once, which is why readers keep coming back over and over again.
And I want to pick up on that. For you, Michael, what do you think makes The Great Gatsby so great?
I think it connects to a major change that occurred in Americans' attitudes towards economics in the 20th century, and it sort of epitomizes feelings about the rise of a new kind of economy.
And we're talking about the 1920s, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And
right.
And this is the Roaring Twenties,
right? And but I can give you some numbers that would indicate one of the things that happened in the 20s is that being in debt, which means spending more than you earn, in a sense, became normal.
Wow.
And it's quite striking because before World War I, the average American had twice as much savings as debt. So the average American was not in debt. By 1925, when the book came out, the average American had twice as much debt as savings. Going into debt became normal. And
well, and that sounds like today.
It does. And that also connects to the book very tightly because to allow Americans to go into debt, what they were going into debt for, obviously, was cars. But they couldn't legally borrow the money to buy cars in 1920 until the government passed some laws that legalized a kind of lending that had been illegal before that. One business historian said that there were no good loan sharks before 1920. And then suddenly they were all converted by law into businessmen. So to buy a car, Americans had to get into economic deals with men who had been criminals. And that's exactly what Gatsby's doing. He's got extravagant parties because he's been involved with a man who is could be or seems like very much a criminal.
Let me go back to you, Suzanne, and actually something that F. Scott Fitzgerald apparently told his friend Edmund Wilson. This is just in The New Yorker. He says, of all the reviews, even the most enthusiastic, not one had the slightest idea what the book was about. I even think today when people say The Great Gatsby, they think Gatsby's a great guy.
I mean,
there's a kind of essential possibility of misunderstanding.
Right. And I think from a literary perspective, that's the trick of the novel. I think on the one hand, you know, the idea that Gatsby is a seductive, handsome, successful figure whose longing for a woman excuses everything. It's, you know, his dream of belonging. And that's a dream almost all Americans can relate to. But when you get down, when you dig down one layer below that, what you find is that Gatsby is an amoral opportunist who is exploiting people, who translates the woman that he loves into an object. He calls her the Grail, for example, and who essentially is trying to steal another man's wife for the majority of the action in the novel. So when you dig down, you realize, of course, Nick falls in love with Gatsby, and so do most readers. But there's enough other information about who Gatsby really is in the book, a lot of sinister connections, mysterious antecedents, that if you're reading it carefully, you pick up on the critique, the deeper critique of the book, which is that you maybe shouldn't be seduced by Gatsby.
Even though the narrator, as you say, Nick, what, is seduced
is
by Gatsby?
And it's to capture Fitzgerald's ambivalence, right? I mean, because on the one hand, he was He loved wealth, comfort, leisure. He wanted to belong to that world. But like so many of us, as much as we want to belong to it, when we don't feel that we get entrance into it, we get suspicious, jealous, envious of it as well.
One of the original titles, Michael, was A Trimalchio and West Egg. And I'm just wondering, would we be talking about this book if it had that title?
No. I mean, Fitzgerald himself said that nobody would have known what he was referring to. And he was referring to, you know, the Petronius and this big, orgiastic world. That question of, are we drawn into an orgiastic world or not? That's, I think that's what Suzanne's raising, and that's what I think the book's about. But I think we all are attracted to it. And the question of consumption remains to this day something that's, you know, exciting and dangerous.
Mm. Mm. But do you see this as a critique of the American dream? I mean, that sounds so clinical and cold even when I ask it.
No.
I mean, because it's more ambivalent than that?
I think it's about a transformation occurring in the American dream, where I'm saying earlier the American dream was to be very solid, to have your solid house and your solid family and be sure that nothing was dangerous and you weren't indebted to anything. And the American dream became instead the excitement of being able to have things that you haven't earned, to be able to spend money you haven't, to be able to be much bigger than you think you are, and to constantly get bigger, to constantly dream. So it's a different kind of dream. And I think it's advocating that.
Well, but also,
go ahead, Suzanne.
If you watch the evolution of James Gatz, because he starts off as James Gatz from North Dakota with this sort of vaguely ethnic name, you know, very much an outsider, and then becomes Jay Gatsby when he's 17 years old and wants to repeat the past, he never evolves in some sense beyond that 17-year-old conception of himself. And it's there that I start to detect a little bit of that criticism. And I think also, you know, when you look at the other titles, not just Trimalchio, but he also, right at the end, he wrote a quick letter. He said, can we change the title to Under the Red, White, and Blue? He wanted that to. So I think what you feel, even in all the titles that were in contention, is the tension between this celebration of consumerism and a potential critique of the direction, you know, that America was going in.
But just picking up what you just said, though, Suzanne, I mean, the part of the American dream is this notion of reinvention and the idea that you could change your name. I mean, how many people in this country have either changed their names or had their name changed? And then the idea of assuming a different kind of identity.
Right. But ultimately, what happens to Gatsby? I mean, this is where the limits of what Thorsten Veblen called pecuniary emulation comes in. Pecuniary emulation means that you buy in a discriminating way to try to display status, you know, so that you say, this is the world that I belong in.
Right.
But Gatsby gets it all wrong. He always gets it wrong. The best line in the book for this is when Tom says he's an Oxford man like Kelly is. He wears a pink suit. Right? Gatsby gets it wrong. So he's that young, ostentatious, never fully evolved, and that ultimately blocks his entrance into the world that he wants to get into.
But do you think it's about the nouveau riche, Jay Gatsby, and the more sort of blue blood established upper class, Tom Buchanan?
I think it is, but I don't think it's just, I mean, I think that feels like a critique of the nouveau riche, and I think instead it's suggesting that the avenues of getting into the upper class are blocked. And that's what I think resonates with today, is that, you know, there's a core of very rich people that you can't join. And the dream of joining them is a dream of reinventing yourself as something out of the class that you've been pushed into. And so I think the country is even moving towards, it moved from the 20s on toward helping people have the image and the vision of being able to do more.
F. Scott Fitzgerald writes about Tom and Daisy Buchanan. They were careless people. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money.
Right.
I mean, that's a powerful sentence.
Well, and I think that's the other level of critique of the book, too. The part of the book that is very sympathetic toward Gatsby, because I think there's a huge part of Fitzgerald. I think Fitzgerald identified with Gatsby to a certain extent. So I think he was sympathetic, but the other level of critique is the critique of the Tom Daisy. What is Tom? He's a horse breeder. He has no occupation. He's a polo player. He's a polo player. He breeds horses. He's all about pedigree, bloodlines. He's obsessed with race, genetic determinism, right? So he's always focused on protecting his world. And that is then the other critique, which is we think we live in a meritocracy. Mm-hmm. We think we live in a world where you can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. But there are things that Fitzgerald once called it the indiscernible barbed wire between us and the upper classes. And you will never get all the way across.
Do you see that class issue at play?
Like, yes. But I think the book is also what you end up feeling, what most people feel, is that you wish Gatsby could have made it, or that, you know, there should be some way in. And I think that resonates with actual economic policies that have been put in place during that era, and especially when the Depression hit, which was all the government was helping people to move up. And consumption, for all of its weirdness, was the strategy. I mean, Suzanne mentioned Veblen, but John Maynard Keynes, who became the dominant economist, classified people by their propensity to consume.
Interesting.
And the point of a stimulus was to increase the propensity to consume. And the way to do that is to take money from the rich because they don't consume enough. They save their money and give it to the poor. So he said, you know, redistribute income so that you will increase the propensity to consume. He wanted people to be consumers.
But what we have at Gatsby is you know, this I don't even know how to describe the kind of wealth and ostentatiousness and opulence that he lives in.
Yes.
And has created for himself.
Right. But that is, I think, even the dream of what a poor person getting a lot of money does. And yes, he does it wrong because he doesn't understand how to be rich. But the idea that there could be a way to, you know, and I'm saying I think everybody felt a certain ostentation in the U.S. when they could have a car.
Sure.
When they could buy a house. You know, these dreams of suddenly being much bigger than you thought you were leaves people feeling weirdly excited and uncomfortable.
Well, and especially because William Leach calls it the democratization of desire. And when he does that, he says, look, you know, we told everybody, now you can have a car, now you can have a house. But for a huge portion of the population, that led to imprisonment, perpetual debt, and a cycle of feeling like the things that you wanted to buy wound up owning you, because now you have to constantly work and labor to maintain them. And that, I think, is one of the really interesting distinctions in the book for me, is that Tom doesn't work, and Gatsby can't even enjoy his own parties because he's always being called to the phone. You know, so he, you know, the place of labor in this book, and who works and who doesn't work, and how we see work, I think, is one of the interesting points in the book as well.
And we're almost having a break here, but just so our listeners understand, but Gatsby is a bootlegger, is that right? I mean, is that how he made his money? Maybe,
well,
or
well,
we don't
well,
know.
No, that's part of his money. Actually,
the pipeline to Canada.
Bootlegging was part of it, but it's, you know, when that's said, Tom says that's only small change compared to his big money. Uh-huh. His big money is revealed at the end, which is that he's selling illegal bonds. And as you know, and what I'm saying is, what's interesting, I'm saying, if you see how that connects, he's to sell a bond is to make somebody else a moneylender. That's what you are if you buy a bond. And Nick is a bond salesman. Mm-hmm. And so the book is all about what's the line between illegal money lending and legal money lending. That's where Gatsby got his money.
Well, and again, that has such a familiar ring to me.
Yes.
As we deal
excessive
with
lending.
Excessive lending, exactly. Well, we are talking not just about excessive lending. We're talking about The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald's 1925 novel that has lived on almost a century now. Suzanne Del Gizzo, Associate Professor of English at Chestnut Hill College. Michael Trattner, Professor of English and Film Studies at Bryn Mawr College, both joining us today on Radio Times. Any Gatsby questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Bryn Mawr Film Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY, presents Critically Acclaimed, an evening with your favorite film critics on Friday, May 10th at 6 p.m. A.O. Scott, Carrie Rickey, Stephen Ray, and Lisa Schwartzbaum will compare notes on beloved films, debate the future of film criticism, and answer questions. Dedicated to Roger Ebert, there will also be a private dinner with the critics where guests can challenge them one-on-one. For more information, BrynMawrFilm.org.
Let me take these few seconds to thank the many listeners who expressed support of our program services during HYY's recent campaign. You continue to come through at a time of further declines in traditional sources of revenue. The result, well, it matters tremendously. I'm Bill Morazzo, WHYY's president, and thanks to you, we're growing our investments in program services, and they're designed to help you stay engaged in your community. You count on us, and we count on you. Thank you.
Tina Gordon Chisholm made her name in Hollywood writing films like Drumline and ATL. Now she's making her directing debut with the new comedy Peoples. It has the backing of hit filmmaker Tyler Perry and features major stars like Diane Carroll and Kerry Washington. So how'd she do? Tina Gordon Chisholm takes us behind the scenes of her new film Peoples next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The newest film version of F. Scott Fitzgerald's 1925 jazz-era novel, The Great Gatsby, opens in movie theaters this weekend. We're talking with Suzanne Del Gizzo and Michael Trattner about this important novel and, of course, F. Scott Fitzgerald and what he was saying in this novel. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why? Let's talk about Daisy. And Suzanne, I'll begin with you. She's a character I don't quite understand her. I don't really connect or relate to her. I don't even know why Gatsby's so obsessed with her.
Yeah, I think that's part of the point. I think Fitzgerald actually said when the sales were disappointing, because he expected sales of 75,000 for this book. Well, the previous two books had sold 50,000, and he thought this was a true triumph of art. You know, he was very self-consciously crafting this book. And when it didn't sell, he said, I know why. It's because there isn't a strong female character. And I think, you know, for a little while, we saw, because of women made up such a large portion of the reading public, and for a little while, we saw in scholarship an attempt to kind of rescue Daisy through these, like, one lines that she would say. Like, I hope she's not
here
a beautiful
is,
little fool. And so everyone said, oh, she's really tuned in. She gets it. We meet her. She's floating around a room. Mm-hmm. That's how she's described. She's completely vacuous. She's elusive. Her voice it sounds like money, and she murmurs, so people have to lean into her. So I think that part of the point of Daisy is that she's like water through your hands, mm-hmm. and she's meant to feel like that. He doesn't desire her. He desires what she represents. She's the Grail.
How do you see Daisy, Michael?
I agree. I think she's a floating image. And I think in particular, the line is that her voice, which is the thing he says, if he could kiss her, he would, her breath and his would incarnate his dream. Mm-hmm. And what he's getting is her voice, which is, mm-hmm. Which he describes as full of money. And, I think it's this dream of a different world of money that he's actually pursuing, not a human being. So that, I think, makes her not really a person.
Rich girls don't marry poor boys.
Yeah, that's Ginevra King's father's line. Daisy says it too, but Fitzgerald got it from the first girl he was ever in love with.
In fact, you say, Suzanne, that Daisy's kind of an amalgam of Zelda and this woman, Ginevra King.
Yeah.
Who was Ginevra King?
She was a socialite, a debutante from Lake Forest, Illinois, that Fitzgerald knew in high school in the beginning of his college years. So she came from an incredibly wealthy family, and they had a flirtation that he read a lot more into than she did. She later said, oh, I vaguely remember him. But it is apparently her father, Fitzgerald apparently overheard her father say, rich girls won't marry poor boys. And that speaks to Fitzgerald's anxieties about his money, his social status, which was very precarious for most of his life, especially in his younger years, and also his ethnic identity as an Irishman as part Irish.
Was he poor, or he just wasn't of the manner or to the manner born?
His mother, this was actually very interesting. His mother, Molly McQuinlan's family, had money. And they had money through, I think it was a hardware store. It was a merchant business of some kind. And his father, Edward Fitzgerald, had the name, but no money, right? They came from an old Southern aristocratic family, but they didn't have any more money. And there's a very famous letter Fitzgerald wrote to his friend John O'Hara, where he said, my father's family looked down on my mother's family for being Irish, but they had the money, and my mother's family looked down on my father's family for having no money, and so I developed a two-cylinder inferiority complex.
One of the critiques one of the analyses of The Great Gatsby, Michael, I read was that Jay Gatsby he's really stalking Daisy. I mean, he moves to this neighborhood, so to speak, and builds this opulent mansion and can see the, you know, the blinking or the green light on her dock, and that he's really a stalker.
That's interesting. I think one way to see, I do think there's something wrong with the way he's pursuing her, but I think it's because he's having trouble with accepting what is, again, one of the shifts happening, which is the norm of casual sex. That in the book, Jordan and Nick get together. Gatsby had sex with Daisy when he was a soldier. And he thinks it therefore defines him as they're going to get married and there's only one true love. Hmm. And the line that he has great difficulty with is when she says, I love Tom and I loved you too. And he's, you know, two? Can you love two people? There's supposed to be only one. And I would say there's a parallel happening in the country where not only are people getting used to, you know, going into debt and consuming, but getting used to that it doesn't have to be a completely settled sexual relationship. You don't have to have it completely bought. You can have, you are in a weird way borrowing some mm-hmm. of your sexual pleasure when you're and for later investment. And you know, one way to say that is that there's a shift from saving to spending, both in money and in sexuality. You don't save yourself forever to one relationship. You spend. You get involved, and that builds up your credit for the later relationship. And Gatsby is actually holding to an older view, believing that he can have Daisy all alone.
Wasn't Zelda, I mean, wasn't she having affairs during their marriage?
She had one affair.
One affair, okay.
Edward Josanne. There was that. And, of course, Fitzgerald himself had a flirtation with Lois Moran. So when their marriage started to fall apart, they both... But that affair deeply wounded Fitzgerald. And to go back to the fact that he's Irish and Catholic starts to speak to some of his more conservative views about sex that maybe we pick up on Gatsby. But, you know, in Gatsby. But one of the things that fascinates me about that scene with Daisy, and one of the reasons why I think he feels the language is I felt married to her after sex, mm-hmm. Was I think because he defrauded her and he knew it. He was in the house by what he calls a colossal accident, and he's wearing a uniform, and he misleads her because he looks like everybody else, and he misleads her into believing that he's roughly of the same class, roughly of the same social status. And the line is he took her one soft October night, or still October night, took her because he had no real right to touch her hand. Hmm. So it really is connected to his masquerade, his financial and social ambitions, I think.
Well, go ahead, Michael.
But the specific thing is, I think that he had no right. I think that's what he felt.
Right.
He felt he should have had a right. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying what the new attitude towards sexuality is you don't really need to have the full right of marriage to be involved. And it took time for the country to get used to this idea. But this is one of the early mm-hmm. books that's, you know, nothing happens for Nick and Jordan, you know, in their careless sexual relationship. And, you know, weirdly enough, that's okay. Mm-hmm.
But do you think it does reflect what was happening during the so-called Roaring Twenties? That there were, I mean, this was after the First World War. People were back home partying. I mean, that's the stereotype. But this truly was going on, and having sexual encounters and wearing short dresses and all those other things.
One of the lines in the book that produced controversy, strangely enough, because it got edited slightly differently, is a funny line. Is that when Gatsby talks about his dream, it's described as a dream of an orgastic future. Mm-hmm. And it got re-edited as an orgiastic future, as if he wanted orgies of lots of people, not orgasm.
Yes.
You know,
difference.
Right. And, you know, the idea that what Fitzgerald was talking about was sort of being comfortable with something sexual that isn't just, you know, exactly the marriage.
You see it that way, Susan?
I think it's, you know, it's sexual, but it's also more broadly sensual. Just, you know, that desire to live in the senses, to surround yourself with comfort, leisure, without feeling guilty or as if you don't have a right to do that, which is something I think he struggled with profoundly. And it's not, sex is kind of oddly presented in this book. I mean, look at Myrtle Wilson and Tom. You know, Myrtle is probably the...
They're having an affair.
Yeah, they're having an affair. She's probably the most overtly sexual character in the book, and she is not at all favorably presented.
And that's Suzanne Del Guizzo. She's an associate professor of English at Chestnut Hill College. Michael Trattner, also with us. He's a professor of English and film studies at Bryn Mawr College. And we invited both of them to join us today in Radio Time to talk about The Great Gatsby. And, of course, there's a new film version. It has been made into a number of movies as well, including a silent film that I read both Zelda and F. Scott Fitzgerald did not like. And we'd love to take your questions or comments about this very important book. And that phone number is 1-888- 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think F. Scott Fitzgerald is trying to tell us? Let me get Joe from the Northeast to join us. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Great discussion today.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I'm a little disappointed. Sometimes we seem to have these discussions only when there's a movie involved.
Sorry about that.
Well, it happens.
That's what we
do. I'd like to say, I've read the book many times over the years. It's one of the first books I read, first adult classic novels I read when I was a teenager. And I keep coming back to it. One of the things that really draws me back to the book again and again is that just the sheer, what I would only call the luminosity of the prose.
Yes.
This is a miracle of style. I write for a living. And I think I've learned more about the art of just putting words together, you know, one after another from Fitzgerald, I think, than from probably any other author. And it's poetry. It's what it is. And like poetry, it can't really be paraphrased. There's always a temptation with this book to quote verbatim and to quote at length. And there are a large number of passages that I've simply committed to memory, not on purpose,
right. But
simply because, you know, they stick in the mind. And I was wondering what your guests could say just about the sheer artistry of the novel.
Well, Joe, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And when you talked about the language, Suzanne went, oh. I mean, it is. Go ahead.
One of the first things I always say when I am teaching the book is that Hugh Kenner said that this is a novel with the linguistic discipline of a poem. And I think actually that is why it's so teachable on the high school level and then again in a different way on the college level and then beyond for the rest of our lives. That's why we get all the tight, tight imagery around clocks and time and colors, green lights, white dresses, white cars. It's very, very disciplined. But for me, the real art of the book is the fact that it looks, the way I put it one time was, it looks like the world after four martinis, you know? It's kind of wonderful and also a little sinister. It's a wobbly book. You're a little drunk as you read it. And the reason why you are is because Fitzgerald does this very subtle, subtle thing with surrealism where he uses synesthetic descriptions and he says things like floating cocktails and yellow cocktail music and
almost Gatsby's, surreal in a way.
That's exactly right. It's surrealism. And it just throws the whole world beautifully off kilter. I think it gives it a lot of energy that makes it unparaphrasable, as your caller said.
Go ahead, Michael.
I would say what the caller is describing is the experience of reading as an experience of consumption. Of you like every single moment. You find the pleasure in a line. You just enjoy the beauty of a phrase. And does it add up to a plot? Is there a formal coherence to the whole thing? You don't care because it's so pleasant to go through it. You know, reading the book is like being at a fabulous cocktail party where, you know, there's lots of beautiful things to see and interesting sensory experiences.
I always think it's risky when you have a narrator. I mean, there is a narrator in this as well. I think it works beautifully, but I'd just be curious about your response to that, Michael.
I don't know what I mean. I think Nick Carraway. I think it's funny because his name Carraway.
Yes.
He should be his name is that he's careless, and yet he's the one that accuses the rich of being careless. And I think this question of can you care or not care, and he retreats into, you know, moral attention forever at the end of the novel, and that's this question of can you just that's like the reading. Can you just enjoy the reading without worrying about does it add up to a moral edict or not? And I think Nick is an ambiguous narrator.
You agree with that, Suzanne?
I absolutely agree with it. But I think Nick is actually one of the he is the triumph of the novel in a lot of ways. Because if you had Gatsby tell his own story, it would be impossible to do that because he would look like what he is immediately, which is an amoral opportunist, right? And he would have to present so many unsavory aspects of his own personality that it would be hard to fall in love with him. And I really believe that that's what happens with Nick. And so Nick is that filter that gives that whole book that double register where we see enough of Gatsby that we know to be suspicious of him, but we also fall completely in love with him as Nick does.
And Gatsby's real or original name is Gatz.
Right.
Do you think he's Jewish?
Well, you know, I also... Gatz. Well, you know,
or
that
German.
Argument has been
or
made.
German.
Yeah, that argument's German. Been made many, many, many times. One of the... Just as an aside, one of the things I want to say is what your caller was talking about in the language. There is a 7-hour... adaptation of this book. It's not actually an adaptation. It's a stage performance by the Elevator Repair Service called GATS, where they just read the book. And to my mind, I went. You have a dinner intermission and two intermissions and a dinner break. It's not for everyone, but it is an incredible experience. And part of what you love is that you get the full language of the book.
And what about GATS? I mean, what do you think?
I think he's meant to, that's supposed to be part of the mysterious antecedents. I don't know that we need to decide whether he's Jewish or not, but between the connection with Meyer Wolfsheim and this sort of vaguely ethnic name, the point is that he is not a member of that privileged pedigreed class.
You agree, Michael?
Yes, and I think even more particular, he represents a kind of image of immigration and immigrants in the country of some kind, and of finding a way to present yourself that fits in, but never quite being comfortable. So that, and I think that is, I think the book connects to, we all have the experience, I think, of presenting ourselves as something and of being in a position where we're not quite sure we belong.
Let me see what Bill from Chester County has to say. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I always enjoyed the beginning couple sentences of the book, where Nick, the narrator, says, you know, in my younger, more vulnerable days, my father gave me a bit of advice that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. Whenever you felt like criticizing somebody, he said, just remember that they haven't had all the advantages that you've had.
That's right.
And I just thought that was kind of an interesting, you know, maybe a little bit dealing with class issues and different things, but it's stuck with me of the whole book. I always particularly like that.
Well, Bill, we all grabbed our book when you read the very beginning of that, and you were almost spot on word for word, but you certainly encapsulated the very beginning of the book. And Suzanne, if I can go back to you, I mean, beginnings of books are so important.
Well, for me, the beginning of the book, not just that line, which of course is beautiful and captures one of the lessons or, you know, possible lessons of the book, but the opening three pages are about Nick and his tone of voice and the fact that he contradicts himself consistently in those opening lines. You know, Gatsby represents everything for which I have unexpected scorn, yeah, or unaffected scorn, but he turned out all right in the end. Or I reserve all judgments, but I hate veteran bores. So he's constantly contradicting himself, and it's setting Nick up as not a completely reliable narrator, as somebody who is really divided, conflicted, not able to see things completely clearly, I think. So that's what the point. And it mentions his World War I service, and it says he came back restless. And I think that there is something, you know, something there that's sort of suggesting that Nick is maybe a little traumatized. You know, he's not seeing the world quite right.
Well, there's more than that. I mean, right after those lines that the caller mentioned, and after saying he's subject to bores, he says, the abnormal mind is quick to detect and attach itself to this quality when it appears in a normal person. And I was unjustly accused of being a politician because I was privy to the secret griefs of wild, unknown men.
Yes.
That abnormal mind, I think, might be him describing himself as, you know, partly psychoanalyst, you know, psychiatrist, but partly a person with an abnormal mind who's attracted to weird, hidden desires inside people. And again, that's another thing, you know, with Freudian psychology growing in the 20th century.
Freud really finding his voice at that time.
Yes, the whole country got this idea that there's deep, hidden, secret things. Another way to say it is that desire became more important than morality.
We're going to take a very short break. Very profound thing that you just said there, Michael Tratner, Professor of English and Film Studies at Bryn Mawr College, Suzanne Delgizzo, Associate Professor of English at Chestnut Hill College. We are talking about The Great Gatsby. We'll be talking about some of the movie versions after this very short break, and we want to hear from you. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know. That's the opening lines of Claire Massoud's new novel, The Woman Upstairs. It's about a single woman who hasn't fulfilled her dream of being an artist and a mother. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Massoud, who also wrote the bestseller, The Emperor's Children. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. As the Boston bombing investigation continues, we'll speak with Muslims who want to tell us what they think their role is in monitoring members of their mosque. Also, what is the enduring appeal of The Great Gatsby? Our critic reads it every summer. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we've been having fun during these breaks. F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby was published in 1925. The reviews were so-so, so were the sales. Less than 25,000 copies were printed before Fitzgerald died, and that was in 1940. Today, it's considered one of the great American novels. Hollywood has made several movie versions, and now Baz Luhrmann's 3D Gatsby is about to open. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio in the title role. We're talking about why this novel has endured and what it says about excess and class and consumption and the American dream. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Suzanne, if I can go back to you, and I'm just thinking of all you mentioned the fact that there's a 7-hour reading of The Great Gatsby, that it has been appropriated and made into movies and made into other theatrical and film things as well.
Yeah, it's been adapted at least four times. The silent film version in 1926 that's lost, and that's when you mentioned right. That Scott and Zelda walked out of. They hated it. There was an Alan Ladd version, which is, we were talking about this on the break, it's almost impossible to find because of copyright laws, and that featured, that was directed by Elliot Nugent. I've seen it, but years ago, and I will say I thought Alan Ladd did a really interesting job because he's a dark, sinister Gatsby in a way that I don't think we've seen. I mean, I don't know what Leonardo DiCaprio is going to do, but we've not seen that sinister side of Gatsby. And then you have the very famous 1974 version with Robert Redford and Mia Farrow. And that screenplay was Francis Ford Coppola.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that was one of his screenplays and directed by Jack Clayton. But that version, well, I'm sure we have a lot
Michael
to say about
just
that
saying,
version.
No.
I love Coppola, and I just, but I think that it's amazing that he produced that script.
Oh, because it was so?
Not very engaging. So. You know, I think it's so placid, and Gatsby is so non-sinister or just sort of a pleasant, good-looking guy.
Like a Ken doll or something?
Yes.
The natural.
You know. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And similarly, everybody has trouble. You're talking about Gatsby. What we're saying about Nick. Nick is almost always presented as kind of this naive young guy who's just sort of listening instead of this kind of person who's a little disturbed and is kind of fascinated by the dark sides of people. I think that would be interesting. Yeah.
But none of us
maybe
have
Toby will
have,
do that.
Yeah, well, I was going to say none of us have seen the newest version. But do you think, Michael, based on what you said about the economy, do you think it sort of fits our culture and psychology today to have this movie about The Great Gatsby?
I think so. I think people are so confused about what to make of the excess. And of the images of consumption, you know, we tend to the idea that you know, I mean, economists are now advocating that we need more stimuli to get the economy going. That you know, actually, there's a lack of spending. There's plenty of capital. People have saved a lot. That's why the stock market's high. But the companies with all their capital are not spending it. Mm-hmm. So there's a need for consumption. But at the same time, what we get is images of very wealthy people wasting their money, and we're sort of anti-consumption, and we get all these austerity politics. So I think the movie has to negotiate that and if it's going to appeal.
Well, and I think also just the tie-ins alone with the film. Well, there are it's almost like a Disney film.
This is America.
Film. It's almost like a Disney film. I mean, there are it's Disney at Tiffany's. You know, there's a Tiffany jewelry collection associated with it and a Brooks Brothers clothing collection associated with the Baz Luhrmann film. So there are lots of opportunities to spend T-shirts that say, I party with Jay Gatsby. I mean,
and even women's fashions. You see this sort of return of that 20s look.
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the things that I've always found interesting about the films is that they become completely, they represent the world as all gloss and none of the sinister qualities of the world. And it's funny to see it now, you know, translate into this this moment where it's tied into all of these opportunities to spend more money. Because, you know, ultimately, that's the thing we always miss is the critique piece in these adaptations.
And to see it in 3D, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know either. I love Baz Luhrmann's movies, and they are movies of excess.
Yes,
he is a filmmaker of excess, and you know every the ability to just put 6,000 different little dots together on the screen, you know, to make a gorgeous scene that then explodes into something else. I think he is the essence of fantasy dream in everyday relationships.
And I guess the question will be, does he get it? You know, does he get the critique, as you were saying, Suzanne?
Right, and it's impossible to say until you see it. But I will say the 1974 film did not get that critique at all. So
let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Dido from Malvern, Pennsylvania. And Dido, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
It's Vito.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I love the show.
Thank you.
I had a professor in graduate school by the name of Kaylee Jones, and she had an interesting reading of Gatsby that said it's sort of a proto-noirish or hard-boiled type of novel. As a matter of fact, I believe there was a piece on it, her reading it in the New York Times not that long ago. I was just wondering what the callers had made, or the guests had to make about that idea.
You said proto-noir?
Proto-noir, hard-boiled.
Hard-boiled.
You know, like the stuff James M. Cain.
Well,
not stylistically, I don't think. I mean, not Fitzgerald's prose, but that you know, that he's one of our first gangster heroes, you know, in the long line of gangster heroes that we'll see, again, with Coppola in The Godfather or in contemporary hip-hop music. And there was even another adaptation of Gatsby called G, which was about rap moguls and Long Island. So, you know, that was a different version. So definitely in terms of theme, it's speaking to that noir genre.
I was thinking you were actually talking to producer Susan Greenbaum about Slumdog Millionaire. I mean, do you see some parallels here, storytelling-wise?
Well, I think, you know, what Slumdog Millionaire represented was a dream right at the moment of the recession crash of a fabulous magical solution to poverty. You know, you're in a country with extreme poverty, extreme difference between rich and poor, and at least one poor person magically gets millions. And the idea that there could be slumdog millionaires is a dream of a rearrangement of the economy. And I think, you know, Gatsby is full of that, too. But I think this caller's, I think Suzanne's suggestions of the dark side of this, I think, frankly, I agree. The movie would be better if it had more dark stuff and more of the, you know, some Nick and Gatsby being kind of disturbed people. There's one scene in the preview where DiCaprio gets really mad and yells, and I'm looking forward to some of that. I think that will thicken the sense of he's just a floating guy with, you know, with a vague
very
dream,
nice car
with a nice car, yeah, and the car is presented as really bloody,
yeah,
that too. So
thanks for the call. Let's see what Rosemarie from Quakertown has to say. Rosemarie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
Marty, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm very interested in this because I'm a former English teacher, still doing some tutoring now, and this book comes up constantly. The students, high school students, have a very difficult time associating those last lines of the book to contemporary society. I was wondering if maybe you can help to tell me how those lines are reviewed on the college level, and why is it so difficult on the high school level?
Well, Rosemarie, I'm going to say just the very last line of the book, and Fitzgerald writes, "So we beat on boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past." Can you answer Rosemarie's question, Suzanne?
I wish I could. You know, I find, I have always found those last lines so vexing and so difficult. Part of what comes before that, however, is this look at What he says, the Dutch sailors' eyes saw the fresh green breast of the New World in that moment when they landed on what they saw as an unpopulated America. And so what I think, and you get this reference to Gatsby and the inessential houses that have been built up. And I think part of what I see at the end of the book, and I don't know that it's directly in this last line, is this wave of regret that there is a dream and there is a capacity for wonder, a romantic readiness. All these words are used in association with Gatsby. But once you start executing that dream, you wind up with a little bit of corruption, a little bit of mess, you know, inessential houses, right, strip malls. You never get the green breast of the New World. So we're always born back to that moment, that originary moment of the dream, and trying to salvage something from what we've actually made of it.
How do you see it, Michael?
I think that last line is, I just think it's the most wonderful line in the book. And I think it is either a touch of what the modernist, more, you know, abstract kind of writers like Eliot and Joyce were writing, because it's about, you know, this idea that you can't make anything, that there's nothing new, that we're constantly, you know, this idea of Eliot recapturing old forms of literature and just piling them on top of each other, just make Ezra Pound writing poems with just hundreds of references to everything on earth, hoping to make something new, but all he's doing is piling up the past.
Huh.
And that idea that there's this dream of newness that really is never going to arrive is very gripping. And I think that image of we're pushing, but we're just the past is just so overwhelming that we just keep sliding back.
Do you think that Fitzgerald is also saying that if you have power and money and class, that you are protected from prosecution or you know, the law can't touch you? Michael?
That certainly seems to be what happens. I mean,
yes, I mean,
you know,
plot-wise, that seems to be what happens.
You know, the two working-class people who had dreams and desires to enter the upper class, both sexual and monetary, are dead.
Right.
And they're dead by a conspiracy orchestrated by Tom Buchanan, who's very careful, very sneakily does this. Seems like he manages to do it sort of magically. It doesn't, sending George after Gatsby, he knows he's doing, but why Myrtle would get killed by Daisy. I mean, you know, each of them kill their, you know. So yes, there's a weird way in which, you know, Suzanne and I were talking before, it almost seems like a critique of the upper class and almost a revolutionary, you know, potentially Marxist view, which some people have seen. But it also can be just bitter envy.
What I love, and I'm hearing from both of you, is that, I mean, I think many things are a projective test, but how this novel, people have been able to find things forever in this novel. And perhaps, Suzanne, that's why it has lived on and seems to still fascinate people.
No, I think that's true. And even if you just look at the history of scholarship and critical reception on the book, you'll see all the shifting fault lines. If there's a moment when, you know, women's studies is hot, then all of a sudden you're looking at Daisy and Jordan. And then there's, you know, the language about race and racial purity through Tom, and that was popular as well. So, I mean, I guess this is what all great books do,
sure,
but they continue to speak to us through our preoccupations now, you know, economic preoccupations, racial, gender preoccupations. So it talks to all of those things in this really vibrant way. And also sort of, again, he's working right down the center of American life and culture, youth, consumerism, mm-hmm, privilege, wealth.
Rosemary, thanks for the call. Let's see what Jerry from Bethlehem has to say. Jerry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks for taking the call.
You're very welcome.
Hear me all
yes,
right?
Indeed. Go ahead.
Yeah. We were talking about this ambivalence, as it were, toward the lifestyle and so forth. But kind of revisiting that at the end of the novel, it does seem that comment about the carelessness of people and this idea of, well, I have to hang out with people who are less careless than I am because I know I'm careless. And the idea that somehow the consequences of that carelessness or the consequences of this sort of amoral attitude and behavior doesn't come home to roost on those who, in a way, are the perpetrators.
Hmm.
Tom, who dragged Myrtle into this thing in the first place, right, by having the affair,
right,
he walks off scot-free. Daisy is the one who I don't think we have any reason to doubt Gatsby's version, right? Daisy was the one actually driving the car that kills Myrtle, and she walks off. Gatsby winds up taking the bullet because Myrtle's husband believes right. that he was the one who ran her over. So I think there is at least a sort of a standing back here and say, you know what, there is kind of a moral dilemma here, that the people who live this way do make messes, as one of the professors pointed out before. This is pointed out in the book. But they don't seem to be the one who have to clean up the mess or who really suffer the consequences.
Well, dear, I appreciate
what the professors had to say about that.
Me too. Michael, let me toss that first to you.
Well, I think it's a strange feature. And I mean, what I've been talking about is this new morality or new ethic that enters the society in the 20th century, where there's a value in amorality. You know, if you stick to morality, you're going to be too restricted. You're going to be too prudish. You're not going to be sexual. You're not going to borrow. You're going to do a lot of very tight things. But it's weird to say that you've got to live, you can't hold to any morality. You have to let something happen, let your deep desires drive you in some way, because otherwise you're going to be just a very restricted, neurotic, restrained person. So I think the amorality is, I think the book is very ambivalent about that surviving, you know, and it's trying to blame somebody, but it doesn't want to fully do that.
Suzanne?
Yeah, and I mean, like I said earlier, if you look at Gatsby, you know, as a character, he is not any less moral than Tom and Daisy, ultimately. He, you know, the idea that his dream, and just because he really wanted it really badly, excuses what he does is sort of the trick of the novel. So the book is about colossal sense of irresponsibility in general at this moment in American life. And I think Fitzgerald is feeling very conflicted about that because he is in some ways the representative of the Jazz Age.
Sure.
He represented that whole flapper, high living culture. You know, he wrote articles like, you know, how to survive on $36,000 a year, which is like $500,000 a year, and said, oh, it's so hard. So he represented that. But at the same time, because of the circumstances of his upbringing, because of the fact that he never felt fully accepted by that world, I think he was very suspicious and critical of it.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you both so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Makes me want to go back to college. Michael Trentner is a professor of English and film studies at Bryn Mawr College. Suzanne Del Guizzo is an associate professor of English at Chestnut Hill College. And again, thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. For more information about the program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, archives, email, Sirius Satellite Radio, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Katie Ricciardi is our intern. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, closing out with the music from Baz Luhrmann's film The Great Gatsby, Jay-Z, Kanye West, No Church in the Wild, featuring Frank Ocean. What's a guy to a non-believer who don't believe in